The White Network presents Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Your host, Carolyn Yeager.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome once again to my Saturday afternoon program. It is December 14th, 2013, and it's finally a bright, sunny day here. High pressure and all that, and has been kind of rare lately, so I feel all perked up today, and I am enthused about my main topic for this show. I have quite a few listeners to start out, and but that is not the reason that I picked this topic, or that I didn't pick it. It just came up in order to get listeners. But let me tell you a little news here. I don't have a guest today, but I will make up for that on Monday's Heretics Hour program, when I will have three guests. I want to tell you about that now, because I will never manage to do it at the end of the program, I'm sure. So on Monday, there will be a panel type, panel, quote unquote, discussion on the subject of Mark Weber and the IHR, which I was first trying to put together for today's show. It didn't come together for today, so I moved it forward to Monday, and now I have an excellent group, and it's going to be an excellent program. The beginning of many more in a similar vein, I do hope. As you know, I have been writing and talking about Mark Weber as director of the, in his capacity, I might say, as director of the IHR, quite a lot lately, but not for the first time. I have delved into this at times ever since I've had a radio program, and even before I had a radio program. I'm not going to say now who the persons are who will be on the program on Monday, because I don't want them to be subjected to lobbying emails from those having strong opinions on this issue. I won't reveal it until my regular program announcement mailer goes out, probably on Monday morning. So moving that program forward worked out very well, because I had just on Thursday received some information from a correspondent that figuratively took my breath away. Not literally, but mentally. And I thought, wow, what is this? And what it is, is what today's program is mostly about, because I also want to be able to cover the latest developments in the so-called Nazi art looting scandal that I have been covering since it broke open. There's some things that are interesting and relevant and really, reveal just how this operation against, what we would like to see come into being once again is how it operates, how this Jewish scheming operates in the Jewish media control in a kind of an interesting light. Excuse me. But first, I will say there are some people who take themselves too damn seriously, and this can get them into trouble eventually. And Rodney Martin is one of them. Rodney seems to be charging ahead to position himself as some kind of leader in the white nationalist scene. Or is it even a white nationalist? Rod, as he now is calling himself, is kind of all over the place as an American nationalist, a national socialist following the strict German example, a white nationalist in the style of David Duke and William Luther Pierce. It's hard to keep up with Rodney and his irresistible drive to make defining statements just about everything that he runs into. He seems to want to identify himself with every alternative viewpoint there is. I'm waiting for him to interview Horace the Avenger. I think Rod has missed Horace so far in his effort to link himself to everyone with a name and a following, or maybe I missed it and Rod has already done so. Now, I know that he says he is wanting to unify the movement into, and he wants to get rid of all dissension and disagreement. And that is the purpose behind him having these interviews with all these various movement leaders in one way or another. But so that would be his answer to that, I'm quite sure. In any case, I now have a single word, though, that best describes what Rod Martin is, and I didn't even come up with it myself. I had to hear it from Bill Fink, but I thought that's the perfect word. That word is politician. Rodney Martin, as a few others are, is a politician, and politicians are always ready to compromise. Politicians also promise things and don't deliver. One thing that has struck me strongly about Rodney is that he consistently promises more than he ever delivers. This is true even down to his radio guest appearances, where he spends a good deal of time telling us what he is going to tell us later in the program, but which doesn't seem to actually materialize, at least not to the extent that we were led to expect. This is one of the things that has caused me to get really tired of Rodney's style, the promising things. Rodney has started many things that don't really go anywhere. He first promised he was going to be putting on German film festivals, which he announced on my own program, The Heretics Hour, on October 10th, 2011. That is over 2 years ago. It got the listeners at the time very excited. But where are they, these German films at the film festivals, or even anywhere? A short time after that program, I read about Mark Weber showing a German film at a small event sponsored by the IHR. And he wrote it up about how successful it was and how much people liked it, and they would be doing more. Well, I don't think they've done any more, but I finally managed to pull it out of Rodney. And it didn't come easily that was his film event, which he did in conjunction with the IHR. But Mark Weber never mentioned Rodney's name at all, as he was crediting it as an IHR event. That was at the time that Rodney also told me that he was forming a foundation to compete with the IHR. He was totally against the IHR. Is from the time I first heard from him, that was his attitude toward it. That was his position. But it seems like he wasn't quite finished with the IHR yet. He assured me that he was experienced in such things as foundations, and he had been a businessman, and he knew all the ins and outs of things like that. And after much delay, he finally got his website up, which he called Worldview Foundations. And when I saw it, I couldn't believe it. It was impossible to maneuver on or even to make any sense out of it. I advised him to go to WordPress and get a WordPress site, because they had organization built into it, you know, and it was easy to follow, fairly easy. And what he needed was better organization. And he said, well, he was exactly looking into that. That's what he was doing. But he wasn't. And he also told me and others, too, that his son was going to fix the problems, which his son was clearly incapable of doing, and they never got fixed, and they're still not. But in any case, this all sounds like idle gossip and nastiness. But it's my, you know, it's introducing you into something. But I'm going to continue with these things later. That's my promise to you. And I think I'm going to I need to cut to the chase right here and tell you why I am doing this program. And I have now linked to the article that my correspondent sent on Thursday, which is from 2007. I want you to realize that is from 2007, and it's a kind of a reprint of it. And it had obviously been attempted to be removed, but this person was able to dig it up somehow, I don't know how that works, actually. I, on my show, on the post for this show for today, that is on my website, carolynyager.net, a couple hours ago, I added that link. I didn't want to add it. I didn't want to put it in there earlier, as I didn't want actually want anybody to be messing, trying to mess with it. Try to take it down. But some people have made screenshots of it anyway, so you can rest assured about that. But that link is there now for listeners who would want to connect with it, and so they can understand what I'm talking about, because this is the main information that is important for this whole quote movement unquote, or all of the people who are interested in the white race and in white politics and so on. And so it's there now. And it says in this article, if you go down into the middle or so, that Rodney, it's an article about Rodney and his new job with the Tula Indian Tribe, Council, which is nothing wrong with that. Now, let me tell you, I am not saying, and I want to make it very clear, that I find anything wrong with Rodney Martin working having a position of administrator with an Indian tribe reservation council, or doing anything like that. I don't see anything wrong with it. But it says in the middle of the article somewhere that, talking about his personal life, his family life, that his wife Peggy is in Eastern Cherokee. Now, you know, it sounds pretty definite that is the case. I never saw following up from there. I have a few other articles that came along later that I managed to find on my own that was a mistake or anything like that. And considering that somebody sent me an email just a short time ago about Rodney's emergency radio program today on the Carolyn Yeager problem, that it is true, and that's otherwise Rodney would not be reacting in this sudden extreme way because of this revelation. So what we find out, and this is what took my breath away figuratively, was that Rodney, who has been saying, and I've heard him say so many times, something very much along these lines, that he was proud or happy to be able to say that he's had his wonderful white wife of so many years, 16, I think, and his 5 white children, that he kind of puts as a banner around himself to give him the highest credibility possible as to what every white man should be doing, right? Having a white wife and producing white children. Now, I have nothing against, I'm sure his wife is very, very nice, I'm sure. And I have nothing against him having an Eastern Cherokee as a wife. I don't care what kind of, you know, but he has been portraying himself very differently. And for that says that he's been dishonest with all of us. And I, you know, that is why I think truth has to come out. You know, I mean, I'm only wanting to speak the truth. I have not been cared too much for Rodney for some time, but I'm not out to get him. But this was too much. You know, this, I think, needs to come out. And I do have a lot of complaints that if I got started, I could come out with about Rodney's style and so on. And probably some of this will afterwards. But I wanted to give right off the bat what is the cause of this problem. And for a man, one thing, you know, that we might notice is that for a man who talks about his family as much as Rodney does, we have never seen a picture of his wife or his children. Now, his children might look white, you know, I mean, and his wife might look pretty much that way too, as far as I, you know, but we haven't seen her. I know he's been saying that his wife is ill. She was in the hospital. So this seems like a mean thing to do, but I'm sorry. None of that is to the point. What is to the point is what Rodney has been keeping from all the rest of us all this time. So I'm going to continue on here. It should go without saying, as I already just did say, that his wife is probably a very nice person, a good wife, a good mother, and all of that. And again, I want to say I have nothing against her. I think I already said this part. Okay. Now, Rodney has made a big point of not attacking others in the movement. That's one of his, he talks about that more and more. And he has been promoting a kind of a big tent philosophy, even though he would probably deny it. But I won't use that analogy, but when men do this, it's because they have things to hide. So they don't want to make it. They want to accept more people, different types of behavior amongst whites, because they themselves don't want to be held to a strict account. And they, for some reason, when they have these things like with Rodney, that Rodney has, they think they can get away with it. And probably, maybe often they do, of those who we don't even know about, but often they don't. So let's look at this article now. It's titled "New Tribal Administrator Makes His Mark on Reservation," and there's a picture of Rodney, and this is in 2007, January, and he has just become the new administrator of the Tule. I guess I don't know how it's pronounced, Tule, but I'm going to say Tule. Tule River Tribal Council. And that is nearby, around in his town, in his hometown, Porterville, California. And Porterville is kind of south-central, not too far south. I don't know. It's a little further south than Midway in Tulare County. I think it's in like the Sacramento Valley, but believe me, I don't know California that well. So, I don't take that for the truth, but, this is where this Tule River Indians are. And there's a Tule River there. And, he's being interviewed and he's being upbeat and he's excited and so on and very positive as he is. And the first thing that it says, he was 36 at the time, 2007, and he spends long days doing his job and so on. And the first thing that I think is important to say is that down a little ways, it says federal, state, and local government tenure are all part of the repertoire of Martin's experience and skill set. So he has been in federal, state, and local government. He has served in tribal government for 13 years, they say here, and came to the Tule River Indian Reservation from Yuma, Arizona, where he served on the Arizona Commission of Indian Affairs. So he started out in Yuma, he was appointed, I guess, to the Arizona Commission of Indian Affairs. He's had this interest, therefore, in Native American, government, Native American government for a long time, turns out. I mean, 13 years from 2007 is 1994. All right. This is interesting to check out this timeline. It says further down that he was a 1993 graduate of William Jewell University. And he was awarded a fellowship, a congressional fellowship, to be a congressional intern for Arizona Representative Ed Pastor during that time, during the time that he graduated, around the time of 1993, or sometime while he was in college, or I don't know. So that's where he would get his federal government experience, by going to Washington, or maybe he didn't go to Washington, but he interned for a U.S. representative. And then state with, the Arizona Commission and then local, whatever they said there. And So in 1993 is when he graduated from college. And in 1994, he started working for the Arizona Commission on Indian Affairs. And in the meantime, let's say, they also say here, I don't want to leave this out, he founded his economic and community development consulting firm in 2000. So in 2000, he had started some kind of independent consulting firm from using his experience up till then. And he had told me, you know, because he first came on my Heretics Hour program in 2011. I've got that down here. I've got the dates of that down here. I don't want to lose my place here. So, but it was sometime in mid or early 2000. I think it was early 2011. Yes, it was early. And so, you know, I got to know him a little bit because I had him on 2 weeks in a row. And then he kept emailing me and sending me lots of things. And he was, you know, ideas for new shows we could do and so on. And news articles and so on about Germany. So, and so I got it from him that he had been successful in business. He had had his own business. And he retired. He was already retired. He'd retired early. And it was because, I mean, it went without saying. I don't remember how he said it, but it was because, you know, he didn't need to earn any more money. So he made a pile of money somewhere in this time between working for government and for the Indian reservation, for the Indian Council, and having his own consulting business in related areas. So he made enough money that he could retire before he was 40 years old. Well, later, of course, in the course of the time, in 2012, he kind of disappeared for a while. It turned out he was in the hospital. He has a history of heart weakness in his family, and he was having heart problems. And they were trying to find out, and they did different things, and he went through different treatments, and it was all kind of exhausting, and so he wasn't able to communicate with me for quite a while. And after that, he told me that was part of the, you know, he told me he had this heart problem. He told me that this was part of the reason that he retired early, because to kind of get rid of the stress and so on, and just relax and do what he wanted. And he could obviously very well support his wife and five children. His wife didn't work. On what he already had accumulated. So that will come into play in a little bit. So to go on here, a lot of this is not important, but then it says, you know, Martin, as busy as he is in his professional life, is a dedicated family man, and I don't doubt that one bit. He has been married to his wife Peggy, an Eastern Cherokee, for 12 years. The couple has five children, Jonathan 11, Justin 9, Abby 8, Destiny 8, and Anna 4. So from this we learn that two of his children are twins, the two girls, Abby and Destiny. So they had children four times, and one time they were twins. The first two boys and then three girls. Very nice, perfect, lovely, lovely family. And his personal life is... He spends time with his family all the time, you know, when he's free. But he works hard, and his job consumes a large chunk of his day. Well, that was in 2007. I don't doubt any of this one bit. But if at this time in 2007 he had been married for 12 years and his oldest child was 11, that made it 1995. So in 1993 he graduated from college. In 1994, he started working for Indian Affairs in Arizona. And in 1995, he married his Indian wife. And so maybe that's where, how he got to know her. Maybe that's where they met. But anyway, that's how it went. And he continued working with the Indian Affairs, with Indian, Native Americans for, until, late 2008 or early 2009. I've got some other stories that give those times. So, I will get to that, soon. But let me talk about Porterville, where I think he still lives. It's also known as Bantown, USA. It's in the San Joaquin Valley, Tulare County, California. You know, a medium, moderate-sized city. I mean, kind of a small, what you'd call a small city, actually. You know, it grew dramatically at one time, and it's all about that. There's a story that I found some information in. Also, they're all in this Porterville Recorder. They must have been running stories about him fairly often, and he must be well known because it's not that big of a city. It's, let's say about 60,000 or something. So, but there's a lot of stories were written about him in this particular paper, Porterville Recorder, and a lot of them have been removed. But, these I found not at the Porterville Recorder necessarily, but on some kind of Indian, news sites. And they had them there copied, and they had links to the paper, but the links didn't work anymore. So, and this one says Senate committee says yes to city tribe agreement. And, it mentions in the second paragraph that Rodney Martin, Tula River tribal administrator, represented the tribe in Sacramento. This is June 2008. So in June 2008, he was still working for them. And it said Martin was talking about this bill that had passed to the benefit of the Tula River Tribe Council. And Martin said he was on cloud nine. He was so happy. It was a blowout vote. And he made it clear, they write, that the well-crafted bill in no way relieves the tribe of its power as a sovereign nation or affects eminent domain. The tribe won't give up its sovereignty, nor will the city give up its jurisdiction. So whatever, you know, that's all that's in that one. But then this one is more important because I found one from 2010, February 26, 2010, and it was titled Card Room License Suit Settled. And it's also in the Porterville Recorder. And it says the Tula River Tribe has reached a $425,000 settlement of a civil lawsuit with some Porterville entrepreneurs over a controversial card room license deal. A sales agreement, the card room is a gambling, you know, it's part of gambling because as you all know, these tribes are allowed to run casinos and most of them do. And Tula River also has a casino. And this was, I really can't say I understand what all this is about, but as best I can figure from what I have, this was about a lawsuit, and a sales agreement was struck in 2007 that would have transferred the card room license of the mint to the tribe, and they were to pay $800,000 for it. The tribe was. And the tribe's lawsuit alleged the tribe was now suing these people. And they allege that the money that they paid for the card, meaning the card room, was never, or the one giving the license for it, was never returned after the state made a decision not to allow the transfer. So they were suing for that $800,000 plus probably damages. And there was a settlement, and the terms of the settlement agreement allowed 5 years for only $425,000 to be paid to the tribe. So instead of the $800,000, the tribe was going to get $425,000, and it could be paid over a 5-year period by the. These were some entrepreneurs who they were dealing with. They have names, but I'm not going into them. The tribe filed the lawsuit in October 2008. It says defendants named. I'll read these names. These are the people who had the card room license that that the tribe was trying to buy from. James Podergua, Podergua, four officers in the corporation. Podergua was the main spokesman. David Gonzalez, Sherry Arlene Gonzalez. They must be husband and wife, maybe. And Stephanie Ellen Wynn. I mean, that doesn't mean anything. But it does mean that Rodney was administrator at this time in October 2008 when the tribe filed the lawsuit. And it says the $800,000 was intended to purchase the card room license of the Mint card room, which this Podergua had previously operated adjacent to the Palm Tree Inn Motel. The California Gambling Control Commission, however, did not approve the Mint's license to be transferred to the tribe. Had the tribe been allowed, and now it says, this article says, had the transfer been allowed, the tribe would have been the first Indian tribe to operate a card room under California law. I guess that's where you can go in and play cards for money. You know, I think that's the impression I have. The tribe's main cash source, the Eagle Mountain Casino, now that's what they own, the Tula River tribe owns the Eagle Mountain Casino, is allowed to have card tables with gambling because it is on tribal land not covered by state gambling laws. But off-reservation card rooms in California are regulated by the state commission. So I guess they're buying this. I don't know. Anyway, they were going to put it somewhere off their reservation. And right now, it's operated in 2010. This was card room called the Mint, was the only card room operated under California gambling control regulations. So California had okayed it because it was on California land. Anyway, it says further down that at the time the card room license sale was made public in November 2007, then tribal administrator Rodney Martin, well, we know he was there in 2007, Rodney Martin said the time frame of the sales contract with Podergua was challenging, quote, challenging, but that he believed the tribe would be able to complete the requirements or be granted an extension provided for in the sales agreement. Well, I guess that didn't work out that way, but it was a good effort, I suppose. And then it goes on giving lots of stuff about this, what was done and who did what and all about this, what was happening. Well, that has nothing to do with us, with our interest. But a little further down, it says, my client has been requesting, this is a quote, but it's kind of strange quote. My client, who's saying this? A letter from Podergua's attorney, Greg Chambers. Okay, this is in the attorney's, the entrepreneur's attorney's letter to whoever. He says, my client has been requesting an answer, counter offer, from the tribe for the last 2 months. Mr. Rodney Martin, tribal administrator, assured my client that the tribal council would consider his request on January 24, 2008. And again on January 31st, 2008, my client has still not received any form of communication. And he says, goes on to say his client is frustrated, you know, by the lack of communication. Then he wrote another letter to the tribe's attorney, and that said, you know, give what's in that. But then the final paragraph of this article is interesting to us because it says, tribal administrator Sam Cohen declined to comment for this story on behalf of the tribe. Cohen worked for the tribe in another capacity prior to the card room deal and became tribal administrator late last year, which would have been late 2009, because this was written in early 2010, as I said when I started out. So Cohen became tribal administrator in late 2009 after former tribal administrator Rodney Martin left the tribe's employment. So this is just a little, you know, something that we know that Jews have gotten very involved with Indian tribes and reservation business and so on because of the gambling, because there's a lot of money to be had there, because these tribes, because of their right to have casinos, take in a lot of money if they do it right, and they need help in doing it right. That's why they have administrators like Rodney Martin and like this Sam Cohen. They have that because they can't do it themselves. They don't know, but they, and so they pay these people well. At least I'm sure Cohen was paid well to operate things for them the way they should be and make the right decisions and so on. And so there's a lot of Jews get involved in that. There's a lot of money, and there are a lot of Indians, I should call them Native Americans now, who have gotten very wealthy. I don't know how if they're very good at handling their money, but they've gotten very wealthy. And they personally, they have a lot of money, and they've been quite willing to do illegal things and to go against the law. I'm not saying they all do, but we've read of scandals and stories where we've read about this, and it's always Jews involved. So this is not unusual, but it's just, it shows that, Rodney got this job, and he was worked hard at it, and he's very happy about it. And the person who took over from him when he left, and we don't ever know why he left, but maybe because he wanted to retire, that he had enough money, I don't know, but was this Jew Sam Cohen. Now, I want to say that I don't find anything improper in any of this at all. Nothing, except when Rodney Martin came into the white, or he didn't even start out in the white nationalist movement. He started out wanting to get into historical revisionism. And he went first because he was aware of it. He lived in that area. And he went, and this is exactly what he told me, too, back when, that he went to the Institute of Historical Review because he thought that was the place. Well, that's certainly understandable. You know, that was the place where this business was going on. Yeah, he didn't know anything about the history of it, but, you know, it didn't really matter too much. And because he was a contributor, he told me he started contributing to the Institute. Of course, Mark Weber made room, you know, made time to talk with Rodney Martin, who would look like a very good prospect for the future. And Rodney said he would go over there and sit and have conversations and discussions with Mark Weber. And he said he gave Mark Weber what he thought was good advice and some criticism and so on. And Mark was very agreeable to listening to it, but he didn't think he ever did anything about it. And he eventually got, he told me he eventually got either suspicious or disillusioned or something with Weber. And around that time, he must have been listening to Voice of Reason radio, and he liked my radio program, and he liked me, what I was saying and so on, because I believe that Rodney Martin is sincere about his interest in the Third Reich and in Hitler and in World War II and all of that, and I don't doubt that one bit. But so he started moving along into this, and I'm trying to point out that he started out not about promoting the white race so much. It was about Germany. And he relates to Germany through his German grandmother. Now, here's another thing that I'm going to bring up. I've thought about this so many times and wanted to say it. But I didn't, you know, because I really am not into just trying to point out any little thing wrong with somebody or discrepancy. But he says a lot. He's German. I'm German. And he mentions his German grandparents, which are, you know, one set of grandparents, as far as I can tell, and this particularly this grandmother. But I'm wondering about his other set of grandparents. If they are German or not German, he never talks about them in particular. He just talks about this one. So, the thing is, you know, he got that connection, but I don't know if it's from his whole family, and, I don't know what his total ancestry is. He always says he's German, but I don't think he's made a point of making that very clear. So, but he likes it. And, when he started writing to me, you know, sounded good. So, I had him on a program, and the first program of mine he was on was on July 18th, 2011. So he left the tribe in, work with the tribe, as tribal administrator in late 2009, very late 2009. And so from 2010 to July 2011 is just a year and a half. And he was, you know, getting his bearings. He was connecting with the IHR. He was deciding he wanted to get into this. He wanted to contribute, he told me, to this movement. And as he got into it more and more, he found, he found the whole white nationalist scene, and he wanted to be in that too. Just like, you know, as I say, I think he has the personality of just wanting to be in everything. I mean, he started so many things. I haven't gone into all that yet. Then he gets ambitious about it because that's his nature, and he wants to, you know, set the tone and how it's going to be done, because he's a kind of a take charge guy. And so there we have that. So he came on my program. I did a regular kind of interview program with him. You know, I took him at his word for everything, and he seemed like just the perfect man, right? I mean, his family man, even homeschooling his children, he and his wife homeschooling their children, 5 children, homeschooling them, and all of these things. And, you know, I was like, you couldn't find any fault with him whatsoever. Not that I was looking for it. You know, I mean, why would I? I asked him to come on the next week, because at that time, this was called Outrage and Violence in Europe. That's when Rudolf Hess's grave was invaded and desecrated and his body's removed. And that was such an outrage. And I said, well, you know, he was writing me about it. I said, why don't you know, come on again this week and we'll talk about that. And he was happy to do that. And then after that, he was wanting to come on as often as he could. And he would tell me, he would send me articles about things, and he would also suggest topics that we could do together. So, but I waited until October 10th. He may have been, I don't know, he may have not been so available during that time, or I was just didn't want to do any more Rodney Martin for a while. But he came on October 10th, and that's when he did his very popular show with me, and he talked about films of the Third Reich. And I mean, everybody liked that. I got emails about it. He said he got a lot of emails about it. And so everybody was waiting for him to be, he was promised he was going to put on all these film festivals. That's what he was going to do. Well, and I already told you what happened with that. He was actually working with Mark Weber at the IHR. At the time, he was telling me that he didn't want anything to do with Mark Weber. He was finished with that, and Mark Weber was no good, and so on. But actually, and when I said, oh, Mark Weber did a film festival. Well, that was actually, he finally admitted, that was actually his film festival. But he let Mark Weber do it. You know, he did it under the auspices and so on and whatever. So I thought, okay, well, I thought that was kind of unfortunate, but that's the way it was. And So then in October 25th, the films program was so popular. So I got my friend Willie Chrisman to come on again as Dr. Wilhelm Chrisman, which he is Dr. Wilhelm Chrisman, but, you know, I always made sure I called him that on the programs, to talk about painting and music in the Third Reich. And Rodney, the three of us did that. And then we decided to do some more. And Rodney had a whole list of these things to do. But it turned out if I hadn't been there and if Wilhelm hadn't been there, he wouldn't have known that much about it. He would have said the most, you know, obvious things. I mean, Rodney. But they turned out to be pretty good programs. The November 1st then, so these are all pretty close together there, sculpture and architecture in the Third Reich. Well, those last two came one after the other. And then Rodney was wanting to do education. So we planned one on education. And but he then didn't show up. Wilhelm and I did it together on November 8th. That was the following week. See, we're going to do this whole series of them. And I think that's when he got sick. I finally found out, or maybe I found out right at the time. I can't remember. But that his heart problem came up again, and he had to go to the hospital for a while. And they were doing some processes on him. So that was just Wilhelm and I on the education show. And then the last program that Rodney Martin did with me was February 27th, 2012. After he said he was all well again, and he wanted to do Germany's first in science, medicine, and health, and talk about the patents and so on, a Nazi Germany, how they were, you know, so far ahead of everybody else. And I said, well, that sounds great. All right. And, you know, I read some stuff about it myself then for the show. I always prepare for shows. I don't know how not to. I mean, I couldn't imagine not doing it. So, but I try to let Rodney give most of his stuff. And then I found the strange thing was that like a week or two after that show of ours, Mark Weber was doing podcasts for Voice of Reason then. And Mark Weber did a podcast on that exact topic using much of the same information and the same book and so on, mainly focusing on Germany's anti-smoking campaign and that smoking caused cancer and stuff. And nobody else was talking about that. They're all still the Allied countries still trying to, you know, encourage everybody to smoke and so on. And I said later that Mark Weber had copied our program. But now I'm thinking that Rodney Martin never stopped his communication with Mark Weber and never was against Weber in the way that he pretended to me that he was. In fact, he was prepared to come on a program and talk about how bad Weber was as a director and what their yearly statements showed, that he knew how to read those things. Well, it turned out I said, tell me what you're going to say. And what he was going to say was no different than what anybody else would say, what I would say. So I never did do that show with him. I just kept holding off and I talked about it myself. But I thought that, because I didn't think he had anything new, like he promises that he has something new. And at that time, I don't know, some those other shows kind of bothered me. Something was bothering me. So, I was blaming Mark Weber for stealing that topic from our show, but I know now that Rodney was talking about that with Weber too, and Weber might have had that topic before Rodney did, and Rodney heard about it from him. I don't know. These are kind of inconsequential things you would think, but in the whole picture now, all this stuff makes a little bit of difference. It makes a little bit of sense. So it's not like I don't know Rodney Martin. It's not like I've just got something out for Rodney Martin. I know him quite well, and I had a lot of communication with him, and he was on my programs, and I was, you know, all for him. And Willie Chrisman was also very, because he, you know, I introduced him. He was very friendly to Rodney too. And Rodney then asked Chrisman if he would allow him, if he would do one of those life story things. I can't think of what they're called. Where you're supposed to just go and turn on the recorder, and you let the person who, in this case, these were people who experienced Nazi Germany firsthand, or National Socialist Germany firsthand, and in Wilhelm Crispin's case, the war, he was in the war from 39 to 45 as a pilot in the Luftwaffe. And you just turn on the recorder and you let them tell their story, however they tell it. And you let, you know, you prompt them once in a while, you bring up a question. But Rodney's unable to do that. And he, Willie told him he would do that for him. And he invited Rodney to come to his home in, can't think of the town now. Anyway, up there in Northern California. And, what Rodney brought his son along, and when I listened to it, to the results of it, I couldn't believe it, because Rodney was doing most of the talking, and he would start bringing things up, and he'd say, "Do you agree with that, Dr. Chrisman?" And Willie would kind of be taken aback. Of course, he sometimes was kind of taken aback by me too when he was on my shows, but he said, yes, I do." He was aware of what Rodney was doing, but he was gentlemanly. He was always so gentlemanly. He just went along with it. And he said that Rodney stayed too long because he got really tired and Rodney just didn't seem to want to leave. And then he had to get pictures and so on. Anyway, I brought that up to Willie Chrisman. I said, I couldn't believe when I listened to that because we talked all the time. I couldn't believe that because, he was doing all the talking. It was supposed to be just you and your remembrance of how things were. "I know," he said, "I know." And I said, "Well, what was your impression of Rodney?" And he said, "I don't want to say, you know." Well, then I knew it was, I said, "Well, tell me." "Well, I don't want to say," he said. "Well, what do you think?" You know, I said, to me, he's pompous. And then Willie said, that's it. And this is, you know, I now call it self-importance, but the biggest fault that Rodney Martin has, and I suppose I'm now getting into things maybe are not all that necessary, but is this sense of self-importance and this pompousness, which is what finally just completely turned me off. And I have been feeling that for quite a long time, you know, since that time. Well, when was this? Since 2012. So now I'm going to turn to, it's almost time for the break, ladies and gentlemen, but I'm going to turn to Rodney's essay or post, whatever, that he put on his website, wvfoundations.org, entitled "The Circular Firing Squads Must End." And why I am doing all this is because of the part where he says he's taking it out after me. I don't blame him for that. He has every right to, since I have, you know, said some things about him, I suppose, in kind of veiled terms. But mostly he's unhappy because of what I'm doing about Mark Weber, though. But here he says, "I partially agree with Carolyn Yeager that there should be some, quote, unforgivable sins, quote, in our movement. I would include miscegenation, beating your wife and children, sex crimes, drug use, informing on our comrades," and here he is referring to Glenn Miller, who he brings up later, "and throwing a comrade under the bus to make oneself look good in the eyes of our enemies as primary offenses." Well, this is not the only place where he says the number one offense is miscegenation, and he talks about that. He's, you know, in other places at other times, and yet he is guilty of that very thing. So that is where the problem is, ladies and gentlemen. And that is where is the problem in this so-called movement, with more, I don't want to make judgments about quantity of people or whatever or who, but, you know, it's dishonesty about one's failings is not good. You know, if you got failings, you either have to, you know, say I don't belong here, or else admit what they are and come out with them and see how it goes. But you can't cover it up. And then to go and attack others for the very things that you are so guilty of, and you think that you're going to keep people from finding out about it. This is, this is unforgivable. So he's right. Miscegenation is one of the unforgivable sins. It can be forgiven if people are honest about it, and there's a lot of understanding for that. But Rodney hasn't done that. So I'm at the 60-second mark before we go to the break. So there's no sense my starting into this right now, and I'm trying to think of what I can say. I have more about Rodney after I talk about this, enough to get me by to take up some time. And then I do want to talk about the looted art business, but I did say that I would take phone calls after the break in the second hour, so I will, but please, I hope that I don't get just crank calls or hate calls or something, and that anybody who really wants to have something to say. So we'll be back in 5 minutes, ladies and gentlemen, and with trying to complete all of this today.
Kann er dir an dich denkt, nur eine einzige Zahl erinnert an deine Qual. Keiner kommt mehr hierher, niemand vermisst dich mehr. Oh, es tut weh, wenn ich deinen Stein so sehe. Treuer Soldat, mehr als ein namenloses Grab. Ich wünschte, ich hätte ein Gespräch. Du Kamera, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben und bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Bitte greift sie lieb ab, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein. Ich schwöre dir, so wahr ich hier stehe, ich trage die Fahne, wohin ich auch gehe. Nie werde ich euch verraten. Für kein Geld der Welt, ich kämpfe für dich, ungebrochener Held. Ich kämpfe für dich, unbekannter Held. Doch ich höre deine Stimme, ich gedanke zu mir sprich. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben und bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nimm dem Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein. Und wer da noch lügt, euer Namen benutzt, eure Heldentaten durch Geldgier beschmutzt, den trifft das Schwert von unsichtbarer Hand, ein Totenwächter. Von Wotan gesandt, ein Totenwächter im schwarzen Gewand. Doch ich höre eine Stimme, die sanft zu mir spricht. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben, bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Bis an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nimm dem Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Keine Hand, ihr seid nicht allein, egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein. Kamera, du siehst, wir stehen für euch ein, die Kraft, die wir brauchen, wird uns Wotan verleihen. Ihr gabt so viel für dieses Land, es war der Glaube, der euch verband, es war der Glaube. Yeah. euch verbannt. Doch ich höre deine Stimme, ich glaube zu mir sprechen. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben, bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist es an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nimmt im Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht,
egal was geschieht,
wir werden bei euch sein. Und kehre ich einst an deinen Stein zurück, berichte ich dir von unserem Glück. Dann ist es geschafft und wir sind wieder frei. Dein Grab blüht wieder, darum ging's mir dabei. Dein Grab blüht wieder, denn jetzt sind wir frei. Ich höre deine Stimme, die sanft zu mir spricht. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben und bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist es an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nimm dem Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht,
egal was geschieht,
wir werden bei euch sein.
Deine Stimme,
die sanft zu mir spricht. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben, bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Und ist an der Zeit, überlebt unseren Eid. Wir sind Geiste, die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein.
All right, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager, and this is Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn, and I'm on a very touchy subject, I realize. but since it came to me, the information, I thought I was the one that would do it, so I'm doing it. And this, I want to talk now about Rodney Martin's post or article or essay at his website, worldviewfoundations.org, that is dated December 7th, 2013. And it's titled, and now, you know, I am, today is December 14th, so that's 1 week ago where I have not said a whole lot about Rodney, except, that he knows I'm going to continue, with going after Mark Weber. And he titles it, "The Circular Firing Squads Must End." And he starts out, "Carolyn Yeager grabbed her e-riffle and rushed to the circle to get a piece of the action." Now, this is one thing about Rodney that he misspells things all the time. He doesn't write very well, but he seems to be getting better. I don't know if he's got somebody helping him or what, but obviously when he was an administrator and making lots of money, in these jobs of his, he had an assistant. In fact, I have an article where his assistant, I might have passed by that part. His assistant is praised, is speaking about him. So he has a secretary or whatever to take care of these things. So he means rifle, e-rifle, but he spells it with two F's. So it's e-riffle. But he's saying that I grabbed my e-rifle. That's a pretty clever term. And I rushed to the circle, the firing squad circle, and to get a piece of the action, declaring her suspicions that John Friend just might be Jewish. This while having praised Glenn Miller, who testified against his fellow comrades. And after her self-appointed crusades against Mark Weber, Carl Rattle, Deanna Spingola, and others. I'm adding here, I didn't go on a crusade against Deanna Spingola. I could, but I haven't. I only brought up that thing about John Friend because I thought that was worth something, worth saying, and it was to let John Friend know that what's really going on. But I add here, well, how about Greg Johnson and how about Veronica Kuzniar-Clark? And he could add more people, but he doesn't want to add those people because he sees those people as his enemies. So he's only wanting to talk about my crusades against his friends. And he goes on, and despite raised eyebrows from many in the movement, he puts the movement in capital letter, but capital M, but in quotes, who have been sending a significant number of emails around about the Jewish miscegenation within Carolyn's own network. Note, he says, I have refused to forward and refused to print any of these anti-Jaeger emails on my site. For the record, when it comes to National Socialist Germany and the piss-poor attitude expressed toward women by the men in our movement, Carolyn and I agree 100%. Well, I have said before that Rodney and I have agreed with Rodney on a lot of things that he writes. But when I see how he acts, I don't agree with a lot of his actions. But when he puts things in writing of what he thinks should be, I have to agree with it. So he goes on a little bit about Jaeger being a super critical and, generally being negative and critical of everybody and everything. And he calls me the Roland Friesler of our movement. I thought Roland Friesler actually did a fairly good job in his job as head of the People's Court in Germany. He certainly did a good job when the White Rose Society was being tried. And I read the whole transcripts because nice person, Patty Goldstein, I think it's Goldstein or Goldberg, sent me that book. And it's the great thing about that book, The Right Rose Society, written supposedly by, one of the sisters in that family of Sophie, in that Scholl family. It has all the transcripts of both trials. A really, really interesting, the most interesting part. And Friesler did a very good job, and he was very fair and kind, and in a sense, he wasn't kind to them exactly, but he wasn't screaming and like shouting and hysterical like they like to show him in these movies about the period, not in any real video film, any real life film of them. So I don't know why Rodney hates Roland Friesler, but he seems to, and comparing me with him. Of course, he says I'm doing this for attention, whereas it's really Rodney who's trying so hard to get attention, not through talking about people, but just through being a part of everything and writing emails writing comments all over the place and so on. Anyway, he goes on, he says, he calls this the battle of the blogs and podcast pissing contests, and, just thinks nobody should be saying anything about anyone. My comment is that I disagree with that. I think a lot of this is necessary and has been necessary. And, I don't know if we had the, he calls it the kind of ethics and discipline. No. He says, which I don't agree with, really. He says that the Jews love all this. I don't think they pay any attention, really. I don't, they really. But people like to say that. Oh, we can't do this because the Jews love it. And if we had the same, and Rodney says, if we had the same order, ethics, and discipline that our enemies have, we would be winning. Well, they don't have such great order, ethics, and discipline, but they do have a strong power from the top, which works its way down, and we don't have that. So, the ethics of these people, what about Mark Weber's ethics? How good are they? What about Greg Johnson's ethics? How good are they? And even now we find out Rodney's ethics. How good are Rodney's ethics? So then here's where he says that he partially agrees with me that there should be some unforgivable sins in our movement. And his list is miscegenation number one. And as I already pointed out, this sentence, and that's what he's guilty of. So gee whiz, it's kind of strange. He's a total hypocrite now, and he talks about people being hypocrites and hypocrisy in his program with Sanders Pierce, which from yesterday, which I listened to so I could get to hear the latest from him. And I have a little bit about that further on, but where was I? I lost my place here. Okay. I forget what I was saying, but in that, hypocrisy. Yes. Sorry. He brought that up several times about hypocrisy, how bad it was. And I find that just so amazing, you know, as I'm listening to it. And he says, now the two people who have committed unforgivable sins in our movement are Derek Black and Glenn Miller. Now, he's really got it in for Glenn Miller. And I would just say that Glenn Miller did more and outwardly, and Glenn Miller was out and out about everything in his whole life, his past, everything he ever did. And he did a lot, and he always told the truth. And I don't think that he caused those people that he the order to have anything worse done to them that would have been anyway. I don't think, you know, it had any effect. But these guys, these phony guys, and he's not the only one who just go after Glenn Miller and call him a traitor and all that stuff. Never will forgive him because what he did. I wonder how these guys would react in the same conditions. I really do. I find that rather offensive. So again, you know, he's talking about infighting. He's complaining that he doesn't want any infighting. And he thinks that's because it's not bad for the movement. But in my opinion, the people who are so upset about infighting are people who don't want anything to come out about themselves. And he says, infighting over personalities, money, and outright movement civil war over philosophical differences. I guess that's going on right now, huh? Or movement competition over donations and Alexa ratings. For example, that is, my show or blog is better than yours, is both juvenile, counterproductive, and has got us nowhere. Well, I think that's kind of humorous too, because about a week ago, I had reason to, I don't remember why now, but to look at, somebody told me, hey, your Alexa ratings are looking up or looking good. They were looking good. So I thought, oh, really? I'll go take a look. I never look at them, but I have looked at them a couple times in my life. And, I was surprised how good they looked. And, so I did look at Alexa ratings. After this person said that to me, and it was about a week ago, and I want to tell you what I found. Why Rodney just thinks it's juvenile for people to talk about their Alexa ratings. Well, CarolynYeager.net had a global rating this was a week ago, and you know, it varies. It might be even better now, but not that much. A global rating of 391,282. Well, to have a global rating under 500,000 is considered really very good. And I have not done anything. I never expected to have a high rating. I just do what I do. And, of course, my radio shows draw attention to me. I had a United Kingdom rating of 77,166. And I've always been popular with, I've always had a lot of United Kingdom listeners and readers and emailers and so on. I've always been popular with the Brits. And I tear into Britain something awful. And yet they understand because they're of the same mindset. And, that particular part of Britain, they're against also. So, of British history, I mean. So that's where Carolyn stood. And also, you have to look at views per visit. My views per visit have always been something like this, and there are 6.5 pages, 6.5 pages per visit at the time I looked at this, and that's pretty good, let me tell you. They're not just coming, looking to see if there's anything new, a new post, and then leaving. And so there's to average that many pages per visit is I'm impressed by it. And then 6.27 minutes time on the site. So the average visit lasted over 6 minutes, which is also good. Now, I'm going to go directly. I looked at some others, and I wrote them down at the time just so I could remember them. I'm going to go directly, though, to Rodney's Worldview Foundations on Alexa. And guess the global rating was 8,679,101. So no wonder he doesn't want anybody to look at Alexa ratings. And that says to me that nobody goes to that website. There was no other country listed as being, you know, having any significant amount of visitors. And the page per view per visit, page view per visit was one. And no time was given. So they don't spend any time there. So this is, you know, Rodney Martin is not reaching people with this website of his. And it's not a surprise. Why? So that's kind of strange. Now, there are others that are good websites that are high. Spingola.com is 1,265,190. That's not good. Not good. Over a million. But it's not that there's much on her website. So, she reaches people mostly through radio, and people put her radio programs on YouTube and so on. So it's not like she's not reaching people. And at RBN. And RBN has probably got a very good visitor. So that's, so her website doesn't really count much. But the IHR website has a global, had a global, I've got a call. Just hold on. I'll answer it in a minute. Had a global, number of 427,844. So in spite of the fact that it is such a, you know, a big, important, supposedly site and so on, it's higher than my CarolynYeager.net. By not that much, but it's higher. It has a pretty good U.S. rating, though, 191,589, and it's not, doesn't have any from any in the UK or anything like that. And that the time on the site was 1 minute 54 seconds. Can you believe that? And 1.2 page views per visit. So what are people just clicking on there and clicking off? I'm not sure. I'm not going to do any more. I'm going to answer this phone call, ladies and gentlemen. I have to go to my Skype page. Okay. I'm here. All right, that should do it. Answering, the call disappeared. You know, what causes that to happen? The call just disappeared. All right. He says, can I call in? Somebody sent me a Skype message and said, can I call in? But this person, he's tried to call in before, and every time I answer his call, it disappears. Somehow it doesn't work. So I'm sorry, caller who's trying to call. We weren't able to complete that call. All right. Now, okay, Alexa Rainey's got that done. Well, you know, he goes on talking about John Friend, and a lot of people are a little turned off because I'm not a friend of John Friend, but he took out after John Friend's miscegenation a lot more than I realized, and now he has to deal with his own. So he says that he just says that John is not one of us. But he shouldn't be attacked. And And he says he was taken in by John Friend. Rodney says, I too, like, oh, even I was taken in by John Friend. When actually, he wanted John Friend to join him in his American Nationalist, Association. And he didn't know much about him. And John didn't know much about Rodney. So there's two people, these people getting together to do things, but they don't know each other and don't even care because they have some kind of a name or something or, you know, and they're just taking, they're all opportunists taking advantage of whatever comes up is the way I see it. Well, here's a call again. So I don't know if this is the same one. It kind of looks like it, but I will try it again. Maybe I just took too long before. So let's see here. There. It should be picking up here. It's still listed. I'm not on, I'm on this person's, I need to get back to the white network. Oh, here it is. Okay. Now I got another caller, so I'll try this one. There it is. This is area code 190. What's your name and where are you calling from?
All right. Can you hear me all right?
Very clearly. Very clearly.
All right. Hey, Carolyn, it's Mike Delaney, and I'm actually at 906 area code from Upper Michigan.
Okay. Well, that's not what it says here, but okay.
Yeah, it probably shows 1906.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. That's me. Dumb me. I always forget about that one. You're right. It's 906. I don't take enough calls. Okay. Hi, Mike. Welcome.
How are you doing? Great show.
Well, okay. What?
Well, I wanted to bring up this Alexa rating thing. I find it important because it's not the end all be all thing, you know, as far as ratings go, but it does let you know who's being effective out there. And, I just want to give congratulations to Andre, who recently with his Daily Stormer just passed up TrueTube on Alexa by like 100 points. He's at like 72,100. I got TrueTube at 72.2. And we've been watching it, kind of been competitive with each other with it. And it's more of an entertainment thing, to him and I, as far as that goes. But, it's good to see that I notice people that are being effective are in, the sub 500,000 range. And, that really says, something. But yeah, if you're in the millions, million.
Yeah. Is there such a thing, Mike, as a person having a number like that, like 8 million, because they didn't somehow sign up or they didn't somehow notify Alexa that they exist or something like that?
No, it just, you're not getting the traffic. If you're in the millions, you're just not getting traffic. It's, you're getting a little bit of traffic if you're like the 1 million mark. But yeah, if you're, four,
eight million. Come on.
Yeah, you're not reaching a lot of people, that's for sure. It's
well, you could have a small devoted following that would be effective, mm-hmm. If you're in the millions. But I don't know where all these people come from that to give me. But they say there's other factors that are being used if people are not linking to you. And maybe people are not linking to Worldview Worldview Foundations much at all.
And right. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that, the old saying with any website out here is content is king, and I think, that's the reason that sites like, the Daily Stormer and TrueTube are getting that many hits is because there's consistent flow of content at all times. So
yeah, right.
And it's hard
right.
to do that. I certainly couldn't do it on TrueTube at all if it wasn't for the thousands of people that provide content on there. I would, I got my own personal blog and I've had it for 6-7 years now and it sits at a decent range, but I don't have time to do a lot of content on there.
Well, if you have a site like Daily Stormer, naturally people are going to, when they discover it, they're going to go and check, one or two times a day to find out what's on there. What's new on there? I do, So exactly. You're going to get a lot of people, you know, and, but it's good. He's got a real successful thing going there. Okay. Well, anything else you wanted to say, Mike?
No, I hope everybody's doing all right. I know we got about 2 feet of snow up here in Upper Michigan. It's been below zero. So I hope everybody's staying warm and being hardy white people out there.
Yeah. Well, you've got it tough in the winter.
Yeah. All right. That's thanks, Carolyn.
Okay. Thanks, Mike.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, okay, ladies and gentlemen, I think that is Don who's been trying to call in. He can try again. He did try again, but since I was talking to Mike, I didn't answer it. But, let me check and see. Heck, where's Don? I have to find him here. Here it is. I don't know if he wants to send me a Skype message and I'll read it on the air or something, and he's sending me his number, but I don't use phone numbers. I have a code here so it has to be called in. So I'm going back to, the White Network and let me get back there. Get stuck in these other pages. Oh, where was my call? Where is my call? There it is. Here it is. Okay. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going back to my notes. I have more to cover. Let's see what's important. There's another article from 2013. Oh, yeah. But that's also a pickup from an earlier one. There's a video. There's nothing new there. Okay. Now, let me just comment on, just real briefly on Rodney Martin and Mark Weber. Rodney has had Mark 3 times now, and he's going to continue having him as a guest. And, you know, I've put out my information on how people should be questioning Mark Weber when he's on these programs. So, of course, he didn't take any phone calls. I think that Mark Weber is an important target. And so here's this call again. And so I think that that nobody should be telling me I shouldn't be criticizing Mark Weber. I guess I'm going to try to take this call one more time, but that's it. Let me go to my Skype page. All right. I don't really like, you know, spending all this time with phone calls that don't work. There it is, still
Hello.
There. Hello.
I'm here.
Oh,
I'm
good.
Here.
Hi, Don.
This
How
Don.
Are you? Yeah,
Doing
I don't
well.
Know what happens with you. But anyway.
Well, I don't know either. I don't know either. Yeah, I enjoyed your show about Rodney Martin. My initial reaction to him is beware people who proclaim their own greatness. And he was certainly very loud in proclaiming his own. He teamed up with John Friend, and he had some new organization that was going to save the white race. And I couldn't believe how seriously this guy took himself. I mean, John Friend's a kid, you know, he's in his 20s. What does he know? So you can understand a little over optimism on his part, but you would think a very successful businessman, or at least someone who made those pretensions, would have a more realistic understanding of how the world works. They promulgated this great political manifesto. I can't fairly say it was all wrong. I lost consciousness halfway through it, so the first half was enough to tear me away. They wanted to proclaim our unyielding loyalty to the United States and to the Constitution, notwithstanding that the biggest enemy of the white race is the United States government. The Constitution has been morphed into something that is a mere caricature of what it formerly was and what it was originally intended to be. So I think he's kind of an intellectually superficial person who is drawn to slogans and platitudes. That was kind of my impression of him. He was very harsh about John Friend's miscegenation, and it's interesting to see now that he's defending John Friend against the slings and arrows that, you took after him with. Mm-hmm. Beware those who proclaim their own greatness, and I think that's one of his fundamental flaws. He's very blind to his own shortcomings, and you have to assess your own strengths and weaknesses before you can successfully kick on any enemy. I think Mike Delaney made a very, very important point when he said content is king. And I've noticed in the white movement, it's a very small pond, and it's easy to become a big fish. But if you're going to survive, it's like the people with substance and strength who really make a contribution, like you and Mike Delaney and Andre at Daily Stormer and Stormfront. These are the ones that are really doing yeoman's work, and that's why they have survived, and that's why they are flourishing. I think they're right. The tide of white racial awareness is rising, not as fast as we would like for it to, but it is rising. There's more white racial awareness, and I think your instincts about Rodney King were quite correct. I think
Rodney King.
He will largely. I'm sorry, Rodney.
Rodney Martin.
Yeah, I think he will largely sink into oblivion and irrelevance. The people who rise to the top are the people who are pullers at the oars.
Yes, and you know we have to have honesty, and we can't proclaim that we're giving all the truth about ourselves when we're actually covering it up. You know, that makes you into a real. I mean, that's just a real question there. And let me just say, while you're on the line here, I just had a little bit more about Rodney that I thought I might mention. He did that program yesterday with William Pierce's brother, and now he's proclaiming that, oh, he's gotten tons of emails and people want him on again. And, you know, I know he exaggerates the amount of mail he gets. He exaggerates pretty much everything. But he was saying on there, see, this is what bothers me. He's interviewing Sanders Pierce, and he doesn't even know that their father died when William Pierce was 8 years old, and I think Sanders said he was five. And he just prepared these questions, but he doesn't bother. He doesn't know that their mother didn't remarry and they were raised basically by their mother and, you know, without a father and so on, because he doesn't even bother to read a bio of William Pierce. It shows that he's asked these questions. In fact, he must have prepared this little piece for the show post before the show to be put out, because he wanted to get it posted right away. And it says, "What was life like at the Pierce dinner table? What early events shaped the Pierce family's viewpoints? What were the early influences, childhood, in parentheses, of Dr. William Pierce? Tune in for this special broadcast." Well, he was going to ask those questions, but he should have known something about it. But we didn't learn any of that in the program because Luther said, well, he didn't have an answer to any of those questions because it wasn't like that. They didn't have a dinner table conversations or something like that. Or they didn't, there weren't any events. Actually, William Pierce pretty much was just ordinary, you know, regular guy until he was in college and maybe when he got out of college. Around that time, he started reading things and got into stuff and he woke up to all this. So there wasn't any early events that shaped his viewpoints. This is this kind of salesmanship that Rodney indulges in. And I find this with most of his programs where I talked earlier about how he promises things and he's constantly saying, well, I'm going to talk about that coming up here. And I'm going to talk about this in a minute. But he never really gets to it. Or if he does get to it, it's not anything like what you expected it would be from the buildup. So he's pretty much about promises. That's the way I see it.
Well, he sees a small pond in which he tries to position himself as a big fish, and I don't know what his real goal is. It obviously isn't to advance our goals very much or advance point interest.
Yeah, I don't either.
Website to be frivolous and uninformative and lacking in very much substance. And my initial reaction to him was at a very visceral level. I disliked him intensely. I just thought he was too full of himself and placed far too much weight on his own pronouncements. Having been a lawyer for many years, I've learned to look askance at people like that. If your greatness will speak for itself, you don't have to proclaim it yourself. And if you do, there's something wrong. So that's pretty much what I wanted to say. You're kind of the, from my view, you're kind of the moral compass of the white movement. You kind of steer unerringly toward white interests, and you're pretty good at defoliating these people who would distract us from the real goal. So, as I think I told you before on Skype, I think you're a true leader of this movement.
Well, I know. I don't feel that way. But anyway, thank you very much, Don. I hope people don't think I've put you up to saying all this. You're your own man.
You and I have had our disagreements.
Yeah, that's right.
But I'm a gentleman enough to overlook your shortcomings and your flare-ups and recognize your ultimate worth.
Well, thank you very much. Okay, well, that's fairly said. Okay, well, I'm going to move on now into my Israel and looted art topic. So thanks very much.
Merry Christmas if we don't speak again.
Well, okay. Same to you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I know we got into kind of a bit of Rodney bashing. I got into more Rodney bashing maybe than I should have because it just seemed to come along. But really, the whole point is not if I was just out bashing Rodney, people could certainly judge me badly for that, and I wouldn't blame them. The point is that what I have discovered and what now I've told to you, and you can all look into this yourself, but this is a serious issue. And so and the other was just to show that you know, there's things that go along with that. Someone who will do that. There's other things. And yet, well, we're just going to have to see how this all falls out. So I'm not going to say anymore. And, now the Europe news, that's what this thing is called. There's two stories and they kind of go together. It won't take me too long to cover what's in them. This one says U.S. and Israel step up pressure on Germany over looted art. What's interesting, one of the main things is the United States and Israel are teaming up to force Germany to do things that Germany doesn't want to do. And Germany has been dragging its feet, and rightly so. But, they're probably feeling like there's a limit to how much the world, the rest of the world, led by the United States, and this time Israel's right out in the open with it, should be making us look like they're slaves. You know, they're getting kind of sensitive about it. And but okay, I'll just go on with this. I'm not going to read the whole thing. It's about this 1,400 works of art found in the Munich apartment of the Mr. Gerlitt. And the fact is that it's that they're just using that as a pretext in order to beat down Germany some more and steal all the art from their as much art as they can from their museums and make the Germans kowtow to what they want them to do and what the Jews want. It's all for the Jews. It's all in the interests of Jews because now they not only are complaining about that this. I forgot his first name now, but this Mr. Gerlitt may be able to keep most of his collection unless they can prove that some of it was somehow stolen by the Nazis. And, you know, at this point, there is no proof or evidence that anything was stolen by the Nazis, not anything. They have yet to demonstrate that. But in every article, they use the words Nazi stolen Nazi art and so on, and so it's a known fact which they haven't shown to be true yet. So and then they'll say like this: many prominent people in the international art world have long said that Germany's procedures on art restitution are languid and opaque. Well, when they say many prominent people in the international art world, they mean Jews. That's the international artwork world is made up of Jews. And when they mention that, that's what they say, many prominent people. Yeah, it's only Jews. Now, I think I read that first sentence, so that, you know, that U.S. and Israel are joining together to push some things. And here's some of the things they want. There are two paintings by Bernardo Bellotto, an 18th century Italian artist, and there are some works by German expressionist Max Beckmann. I have put some one of his on one of my program posts. The one of the circus tamer, the lion tamer, was Max Beckmann. He was German, and he was pretty prolific. So there are a lot of them, both in the United States and still in Germany. And it says that these works illustrate the problem because lawyers for the heirs, some heirs, say that they have been stymied by the refusal of German officials to submit to mediation. Well, what it turns out is that Germany is not going to submit to mediation on these paintings because there's no evidence. These heirs have no worthwhile evidence that these paintings weren't properly bought. They don't have receipts that they belong to them. They don't have anything. But they want to say that these paintings once belonged to an ancestor of theirs, which it did. And somehow, now here's the story. Okay, I'll just go from what they say. They say that since it did, since it once was owned by this ancestor of theirs, that and he lost it or it was lost during the time of the National Socialist regime, that means that's taken then that it was stolen by the Nazis, and they want that art back. Well, these are all pretty valuable works of art. And this article says that this, and they always repeat this, that this is causing acute embarrassment in Germany. That in Germany is in the wrong, and they're being embarrassed. A country, they call it, a country that prides itself on confronting its Nazi past, always bringing that up, and its close ties, it says it's causing embarrassment in Germany, which has close ties to the U.S. and Israel. And so, you know, these close ties that Germany has with the U.S. and Israel that were forced upon Germany is being threatened, you know. It's being threatened by this. It says the relationship with Washington has already been frayed in recent months by German complaints about U.S. spying activities and U.S. criticism of Germany's economic model. You know, and I read that and I say, what? You know, Germany's economic model is their own business. And their interests, Germans are solvent people. I know. You know, Germans they're trying to keep their country solvent. That's just in the nature of German, so deep that Germans are always solid with money. You know, they don't throw money, or they always want to do everything. They're not indebted type of people. And of course they have that history of what happened to them after the Versailles Treaty. But this is supposed, they're being criticized for this economic model where they want to remain solvent. And the other thing is that they have the nerve to be complaining about U.S. spying when they have this terrible guilt, and they might be holding paintings back from Jews who are the real owners. Oh, that's serious. But this U.S. spying on Germany is not serious enough, and they, you know, their complaints are causing a fraying of the relationship between Germany and the U.S. This is how this stuff is, as they call it, is framed. You know, it's framed always with Germany is in the wrong and needs to constantly be proving to the U.S. and to Israel that they're good people, and therefore to the rest of the world that they've gotten over all that evil Nazism of their past. Now there's Germany's government has an Office for Restitution, which is known as the BADV. And the BADV has not returned repeated calls and emails from these reporters. Good for them, I say. And a spokesman for Angela Merkel also declined to comment. These reporters, these media people are just breathing down their neck, you know. wanting, you know, bringing these complaints to them. What do you have to say about this? And what about that? And they're resisting. And so now it mentions that here's this statement, referring again to the Munich apartment of Gurlitt, where these 1,400 artworks were found. They have to say after that, many of which had been seized by the Nazis before and during World War II. This is in the article. See, no, they don't know that. It's being investigated, and I don't think the investigation is going too well. We haven't heard too much about it, but all the paintings, not paintings, there's very few paintings, all the artworks, many of which are little tiny prints, you know, and as I've explained before, and most of you should probably know, a print is something that you, can make many copies of. And so they're not as valuable as a drawing and certainly not as valuable as a painting. So that's what a lot of it is, most of it. And it's not all the highest quality either, but there are some well-known things. But the well-known things that are prints, you have to remember again that there's a number of them out there. So, you know, a lot of people have one that looks exactly alike. So they still repeat that many of these artworks had been seized by the Nazis. Well, you know, that's what they're supposed to be proving. We haven't got any results from that yet. And then here comes what the United States is doing. This is the Jew Stuart Eisenstadt of the U.S. State Department Special Advisor. Well, he is the U.S. State Department Special Advisor on Holocaust issues. You know who runs the State Department? John Kerry now. And he said, here's, you know, they get quotes from all these people. No one can have a fair restitution claims process without fair access to information, this Jew Eisenstadt said. And he called on Germany to change its domestic regulations to uphold its international commitments on art restitution, a message that U.S. diplomats are also delivering to Berlin, according to U.S. officials. So this guy is sticking his nose in here, you know, and he's not going to be the only one. There's others, and they're all Jews, who are saying that Germany has to change its regulations about art and in order to make these people happy. And they're saying that there is that they signed something. They signed this, I'm getting ahead of myself, but they signed this accord, but they describe it as different and more than what it really was. And so an Israeli foreign ministry official now comes in on the picture, and his country, he says, is pressing Germany to separate talks to make its restitution proceeding more transparent. They want the same thing. They want Germany to change how they do things for their own benefit. And it says Israel is concerned that German museums could be hiding information about the provenance of valuable works. So now they're accusing German museums of dishonesty and of hiding things so that they can keep these works that somehow have been stolen from Jews. Israel doesn't rule out asking for three-way talks with the U.S. and Germany if more transparency isn't achieved. Well, in the first place, where does Israel come in to having anything to say about this? It doesn't have anything to say about it, but because Germany is afraid of Israel and is under obligation to Israel and Israel can boss it around, Israel comes in. And can you imagine three-way talks between the United States, Germany, and Israel? It's two against one, you see. Two united, United States and Israel, united against Germany. How is that going to turn out? So why would Germany want to do that? They have enough sense still to know that, you know, what's going on and that they don't want to participate if they can help it. In Germany, there's something called the Limbach Commission, and it's an official German body or commission because, you know, it's all Jewish. It's it's tasked with handling Jewish families' claims to artworks held by German museums. So it's a Jewish-run commission, but it's been made official, just like the things in our in the United States where it's really all Jews, even like the Holocaust Museum. It's all Jews, but it's official U.S., you know, supported. And so this Limbach Commission is a Jewish body to handle, to work, it's working for Jewish families and their artwork claims against the German museums. And yet Germany has allowed it to be, an official commission. And, at this Limbach Commission, when you go there, the Jews are going to be acting in their own interests. So they don't want to take it. They don't want to allow these questions to go to the Limbach Commission. And the U.S. and Israel, they just keep repeating that they want that Germany needs to change its country's laws about this. They say the laws don't fulfill the Washington principles on the return of Nazi-seized art, which the German government signed in 1998. Now, they bring this up a lot, this thing about the Washington principles. And Germany signed it, and all these other countries signed it, and that means you have to, be very open and transparent about what artworks you have. And if there are claims by these Jews, it's always Jews, it's only Jews, claims by Jews that this artwork belonged to their ancestor and they have a claim to it and they want it back because it was taken during the war period, the National Socialist period. And that goes from 1933 to 1945. If they lost that artwork then they have this crazy law in Germany that says the Germans went ahead and okayed that any artwork lost during that time under the Nazis is considered to have been seized or stolen by the Nazis. Crazy. It's a crazy law. But somewhere, probably early on, they accepted that when they were being forced to accept a lot of things. And let's see. So, but this Washington Principles was something that didn't have any legal force behind it. It was just an agreement and it was only directed to museums. It doesn't affect individuals who have artwork, only museums. But it was like an agreement. We will work with others. We will work internationally. We'll be transparent about our holdings and so on. And if there are, so that people who have lost art or it can be found and we can research whether, who it belonged to and how it changed hands and to solve these things. The Limbach Commission, claimants groups complain that the German Commission doesn't explain the reasoning behind its rulings and can't compel museums to accept its mediation. The Jewish Limbach Commission head art historian, Jutta Limbach, it's her name, for this commission. She declined requests for interviews and, she has instructed members never to talk to the outside. And now, historians have said that these Bellotto paintings, estimated to be worth about $20 million each, were sold under duress. Now, who are historians? Again, when we say historians, it's like when they talk about the Holocaust and they say historians. They're all biased in one way. They're all Holocaust-favoring historians. In the same way here, they're talking about art historians. This is what they're referring to. And they're all, they're all Jews or Judaized. They're all going along with the Jews. So what they say, who cares? But they say that these paintings, worth $20 million each, were sold under duress. They say historians say that. They don't name a single one of them. But, this is the media saying this. So even if they were sold under duress, does that mean it still belongs to those original owner? Because they were sold. And it says they were sold under duress in 1938 from the collection of Jewish entrepreneur Max Emden to a Nazi dealer who was scouting art for Hitler's planned museum in Linz. So Hitler had dealers going around looking for art, and it was purchased. And of course, you're always trying to get the lowest price possible, but it was purchased from these people. And this Jewish entrepreneur in 1938, Max Emden, okay, so he was under a little bit of pressure, but he sold, get this straight here. Yeah, he sold it to a dealer. He sold his paintings to a dealer. He got the best price he could get, and he sold them. That means it was sold, not seized. And, you know, they won't say that these paintings were sold, maybe not for the prime market price. But in those days, you know, in lots of cases, people are under duress for various reasons, and they sell things. That doesn't mean that the sale is not any good. But yet, they don't even say that. They call them that they were seized, that they were stolen. And it says that German law presumes all sales by Jews to the Nazis to have been under duress. That's what I was trying to say earlier, that all, I don't have much time, that all sales by Jews to the Nazis, if it was sold to a National Socialist person, it was under duress. Now, you know, that's not the case, but that's what they agreed to say. And then the BADV, that German Office for Restitution Claims, is declining to go before the Limbach Commission to discuss the case with Mr. Emden's heirs because they say the Washington principles are not binding and therefore cannot be used to compel it to accept a mediation. And again, it doesn't want to go before that commission because it knows it's not going to be fair-minded. It's all Jews. So another Mr. Eisenstadt, then, this Jew from the State Department, said that such thinking would make a mockery of international norms that Germany has signed up to. Well, they're just trying to attack Germany and embarrass Germany. And here, another thing, Mr. Erbach asserted Germany's ownership of the works and declined the Emden family settlement offer, to which Germany would keep one Bellotto and their heirs would get the other one back. See, they're willing to say, well, we'll settle with you. Give us one and you keep the other one. They know they don't have any claim to these paintings, but they're just trying their best. And that's what most of this is Jews with their lawyers, and the lawyers are just as involved in it and care just as much about it as their clients do, to get this artwork away from Germany and away from Germans and to get it in the hands of Jews as much of it as possible. And so I've got only a few seconds left, ladies and gentlemen. I think rather than trying, I've got a few more things from this other article, but you know, it's just this pushing, and they're all Jews. And this one thing, you got Stuart Eisenstadt. He's formed a commission. It includes Wesley Fisher of the Claims Conference, Mark Mazurofsky, another Jew who's on the advisory commission of the President for Holocaust Assets. And, you know, all these Jews are ganging up and joining together to take advantage of this Gurlitt situation and go into the German museums and take more from them than they, you know, they're just taking advantage. So thank you very much. And do please join me on Monday night for the panel discussion. I think that's it.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.